This episode of the Lawfare Podcast is supported by the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. Law school that fits your life, full-time, part-time, online, and in person. Learn more at mitchellhamlin.edu. That's mitchellhamlin.edu.
Well, here I'm walking around with my badge. My actual real name is on my uniform, and I'm hopping out of a car that screams, you know, police, CIA, whatever, you know, whatever it is. And I go into these neighborhoods and I say, hey guys, trust me, I'll be here for the next 6 hours. And so I quickly understood, I was like, that's impossible. That type of even tactical level of engagement. But it was weird. So we're talking about winning hearts and minds when every single thing we did was to step on those hearts and minds. And we were begging people, and we would have the, you know, I see billboards, they're, you know, trust us, you know, literally trust us. At the exact time, we would never, there is no way I would ever trust somebody. You know, I'm not trusting you, screw you, it's us versus them. And sometimes it's put that clearly, other times it's just like, no, it's everybody wants to kill you. You know, trust at your own peril. And I started to say, well, no, I think that distrust is at our own peril.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 15th, 2020. Patrick Skinner is a police officer in Savannah, Georgia, who brings diverse experience to that job. He served as a case officer at the Central Intelligence Agency, handling foreign intelligence sources in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Jordan. He also has previous law enforcement experience with the U.S. Coast Guard, the U.S. Capitol Police, and the U.S. Air Marshals. That gives him an interesting perspective on today's policing crisis, on what counterterrorism operations and its strategic failures can teach us all about the hazards of the warrior mentality common across many police departments today. Pat joined me in the Virtual Jungle studio to share his experiences and what they taught him about effective law enforcement. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 15th, Patrick Skinner on warrior cops and neighborhood policing. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. I want to talk a lot about your experiences and how they've led you to think a lot about and then start talking more about what policing is and isn't, what it should be and what it shouldn't be. But I want to get there by talking about how you got there. So you graduated high school about the same time I did, and you found yourself pretty quickly in the Coast Guard. Talk about your experiences there and in the Capitol Police in DC and kind of what it is you learned from those early jobs where you were doing a lot of different things related to security, widely defined.
Yeah, so I grew up in Savannah, born and raised, and I was a beach lifeguard, which is the Olympus of lifeguards. So I was a lifeguard at Tybee Beach, which is, you know, Savannah. And so that, you know, I was a swim team, did it forever. So I was really into search and rescue. I did that in, you know, at the beach. And I wanted to do something different. So I joined the Coast Guard. I wasn't really ready to grow up yet, I guess. And so I spent 5 years in the Coast Guard, the first couple years in search and rescue station in Cape Cod. Then I switched like rates, which is like your MOS, to be with a girlfriend in New York City who dumped me a couple weeks after I got there. And I found myself on a domestic icebreaker. So I had a lot of, it was great. I loved every second of the Coast Guard. I did oil spills.
You're telling me your girlfriend put you on ice and then you were on an icebreaker?
No, yeah, I changed everything. And I hope she's listening. It was still painful. But it worked out okay. I mean, who knows? No, it worked out fine because I had 3 years on this ship where I did Chinese immigration out of in the New York Harbor was a big deal. Fisheries, where I literally went to lobster school twice. And we spent the summers doing fisheries off the coast of Maine. Did search and rescue. We broke ice up the Hudson River. And during one of the winters, I think it was 94, it literally is still the coldest winter they've ever had. It was like negative 20 in Kingston, New York, and up in Albany. And so there was real ice. I mean, it was pretty cool. I was on the cover of, I don't know, New York Post or something, where the ship is stuck out of the ice and I'm checking it for a photo op. It's still a cool picture. But I met my wife, Teresa, in the Coast Guard. She was at this air station in Brooklyn. I was at Governor's Island, New York. Uh-huh. And so I got out after 5 years because I wanted to go to school. And I did. I ended up, we moved out to the Hamptons. I was at Southampton College, which is part of Long Island University. And it was a great place to be because all the fancy writers from New York would summer out there and they would teach classes. So I had, you know, I mean, I got to meet, George Plimpton, Joseph Heller, Roger Rosenblatt, Edward Albee, maybe. But there were a lot of people. It was like a steroids. And I learned that I liked to write. And so Teresa got transferred. She was the first female bodyguard of the Commandant of the Coast Guard. And then she moved down to D.C. So we had to get married because we couldn't afford to live in D.C. Got married. And then I finished my degree at College Park, University of Maryland.
Right.
We were living on Capitol Hill. I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I quickly learned I didn't want to teach, which is what I thought I would do with an English degree. I was a creative writing degree. And so we lived on Capitol Hill and I started thinking like practical, like, you know, what could I ride my bike to? And so Capitol Police was right there.
That's easy.
And I had federal law enforcement experience in the Coast Guard, you know, measuring lobsters. So why not? So I went through that. It was, you know, it was great. I went to FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, which is now, but even then, down in Brunswick, just, you know, 40 minutes away from where I am right now. And I did that. And we were supposed to graduate. Our graduation was on September 12th, 2001. And the day before that, we actually had the FBI come and they were telling us all about the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. And all these pagers go off and then everything just, you know, went upside down. And I remember the sheer panic. I was at the Capitol. I remembered it. We evacuated the Senate, or actually the House leadership,
right,
and put them on the west steps of the Capitol. And they said, wait, there's another plane coming.
Boom.
And we ran over to Capitol Police headquarters. And I watched the Pentagon get hit where I thought Teresa was. It was a weird day. And so the next day, literally on September 12th, we graduated. And I applied. A guy in the class, for some reason, had a CIA fax number for a recruiter in Pittsburgh. And so
that's an unusual thing to be carrying around with you.
It is. I mean, yeah. I mean, he's like someone who knew was a CIA recruiter, something like that. And I sent my one page. I think I had, you know, 20 font because I needed something big. And so I applied, like, you know, what, hundreds of thousands of people. I applied that day and right. I didn't know what it was. I had no idea. I just said, I'm applying to the CIA to take the fight to the enemy.
And how long did it take for them to get back to you?
Oh, man. 7 months, maybe. By then I had already switched over. Back then I liked to shoot a lot. And so Capitol Police was a secret clearance. The Air Marshal program got ramped up right in the beginning of 2002.
Right.
So I think by March 2002, I switched over to the Air Marshals. And then right around then, the agency called me. And I still remember, I vividly remember when they called me. I was in our house in Maryland. We had moved from D.C. And then the guy called and he said, hi, you, and he literally said, hey, you applied to the work for the government. And I said, I don't want to brag, but I do work for the government, Air Marshal. And he said, no, the real government. And he said that. And I was like, well, like, my check's clear. I didn't know. And he goes, the secret government. I went, oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he said flat out, he said, I'm looking at your resume. I can tell you're not qualified. I just going to ask you some questions so I can check you off my list. And I was like, perfect. No, great. I had no idea. And this was right before Google. I don't know what they do now. And so you couldn't really cheat. And he asked me rapid questions. He said, is the Indus River north or south of Kashmir? What was the date of partition? Name five towns in the West Bank that are currently, because that was during the Intifada too. And he goes, name, you know, five towns in the West Bank that are currently occupied by IDF. And I answered all of them, not because I was smart, but because I'd been sitting on an airplane doing nothing but reading The Economist and every single newspaper on the planet. And every book I could, because they didn't have Kindles or iPads. So I literally had a bag of books, bullets, and duct tape. And so I was temporarily smart.
You do realize, Pat, that, and you've probably talked to plenty of people who got interviewed, that is not the normal experience. I mean, they may literally have been trying to come up with an excuse to cross you off a list.
Yeah, I mean, he said it. He said, we're going to cross. He said, I can clearly see you're not qualified and I'm going to just clear you off. And I answered the questions, you know, properly. I think I guessed on the north or south of Kashmir question. But I did okay. And he said, all right. And he said, well, you know, that's surprising. Go to this hotel where there's 200 other people. And I went there. And then that's when they peel you off and do the interviews. And then that whole process took a year.
So talk about, you know, no, we don't want to go into too many details about the process, but at this point, you're already doing a job and you've moved around a bit to make that job work. What drew you to CIA? What drew you to leave this budding career and move to something new?
Well, the air marshals, I always knew that it wasn't a real job. I understood at a deep level that once they armored the cockpit doors, you really didn't need air marshals because someone who stands up and says they're going to take the plane over, everyone on that plane is going to get up and beat the crap out of them. And that we were bringing guns on the plane. So I understood it was a, you know, an emergency job that didn't have a lot of life. Funny story, I saw a guy who was in Capitol Police with me. We switched over to air marshals together. And I saw him like 15 years later, a couple of years ago. On a flight, he was still an air marshal, and I don't even know how that's possible. I would have turned into a piece of beef jerky. I mean, it's just God, it was a weird job. But so I knew that wasn't a job. I liked to shoot back then, and they had free bullets, and we shot a lot, IPSC stuff. And so I liked it, but I didn't even know what I was applying to. I applied for a staff operations officer job because we lived in D.C. and Teresa was in the Coast Guard. She had 13 years at that time. And she was about to go to OCS, Officer Candidate School.
Right.
And so I was just like going through the process is really slow. The interviews are interesting. And then the guy said, he goes, look, we're thinking about offering you a job, but not as a SOO, not as a staff operations officer, but as a case officer. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know what.
Describe what you either knew then or what you quickly found out about what is the job of a case officer? What is it that you were signing up to do?
Well, signing up, the only thing I really knew that it was not in D.C. And so that was why I couldn't do it. And so the SOO was like a desk job. But like I'm sure it's different, but I thought you read reports and you take care of taskers back home. You do all that stuff, which I think is pretty close to what they do. And then there was the case management officers, you know, the reports officers who collect stuff. It's kind of like analyst light, but with an operational side. And then the case officers, the operations officers, were the ones that go out and recruit spies. That was all I knew. And I knew that it wasn't in DC. And so I said, well, I don't think I can do that. And the guy said, well, you know, go home and talk to your wife. And I went home and I asked Teresa, I said, hey, I think the CIA is going to actually offer me a job. And she's like, that's great. And I said, but it's not in DC. I don't know where it is, but it's not in DC. And she said, to her ever loving shame, if you get that job, I'll quit the Coast Guard.
Wow.
And you know, jokes on her, I got the job.
So I don't want to go into all the details of where you were and what you did, but I do want to talk about some of your experiences, some of the things that you did that end up creating interesting contrasts for later on. So you were working mostly in Middle East, South Asia. You were working mostly in the counterterrorism field. And that's a little bit different than traditional case officer operations where you're, you know, on the diplomatic circuit or you're going to cocktail parties and you're going to conferences to bump up against interesting people. Your job wasn't quite like that. You were in some rough areas, some actual war zones, trying to get information on, among other things, terrorists. To the extent you can, describe those experiences and what it was like to operate at that tactical level in the war on terror.
Yeah. I mean, even then I kind of knew that it made for a bad case officer over the arc of a career. I knew that what I was doing in the beginning, I mean, which was necessary and I actually enjoyed it, but I knew that that wasn't actual like clandestine field tradecraft. I understood that. There was no illusion about that. And so there were a lot of downsides, you know, a lot of, you know, cutting corners that you would never, ever do in other places because people are going to get killed, but that you also shouldn't do there because people were getting killed. But what it did was it gave me this, it was like a, not even a fire hose. It was like drinking from Hoover Dam in terms of having meetings. Instead of having one meeting every couple of weeks where you plan and all that stuff, I was having three a day. And so I just didn't have to do SDRs, surveillance detection routes. And so it was, I quickly just had a lot of experience in talking to people and understanding motivation and how to ask better questions to get better answers and then how to write notes and stuff. And so it was really interesting. And we had actually some, you know, every success I ever had was tactical, but we had some. I mean, we had some really big ones, and you could see it, and it was interesting. And so I was in Afghanistan, 2003, I guess, and there were very few Americans there, very few. There were some Americans at Kandahar Airfield, and then I guess Bagram, but I never went to Bagram, never. And so I was always by ourselves or with an ODA, a small team of special forces. Mm-hmm. And so I was never around Americans, and you could kind of get out and talk to people. It really wasn't that dangerous. We used to ride motorcycles into, you know, to go to Kandahar Airfield to get beef jerky. which you obviously wouldn't do. A year later, you wouldn't take a tank. And so we did this all the time. But then I started seeing like, so it did a very positive thing. It showed me the power of interpersonal relationships, what meetings were, because it was weird. Like people were like, well, how can terrorists talk to you? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, mostly we're not talking to hardcore terrorists. We're talking to the strap hangers, the people are right on the periphery. You know, psychopaths, you're not going to recruit them. You're not going to deal with them.
And the goal of that, correct me if I'm wrong here, Pat, but the goal of that was to get as much information as possible about the hardcore terrorists. So
yes,
you're basically telling people to rat out the people they've been working with, or if they're in some kind of orbit around, whether it's Al-Qaeda or other groups operating in Afghanistan, you're trying to find a way to convince them. And often that was somebody to listen to. But sometimes, you've told me, sometimes it's they wanted to get back at somebody who'd wronged them, or they wanted to make some money.
Yep. And there was it's funny, the agency always kind of frowned upon people whose motivation was money. And I always say, okay, if I stop paying you, how long would you show up? You know, a couple of weeks, a month, maybe no more than that. And so we always kind of poo-pooed. It was less noble that people work for money, when I sure as hell, you would have to, at some point you'd have to pay me. And so I never bought into that. But I understood that even people that were like in Helmand Province and they were 18 years old and couldn't read, they wanted to do something with their life. And that was that I quickly understood that. Mm-hmm. And I also understood the power of motivation and the actual motivation, not the one they said, because sometimes what they said was not the actual motivation. But if you peeled it away enough, and it wasn't like psychological, it was just time on just listening and talking. If money was their motivation, that was easy. We had a ton of money. If revenge was their motivation, we can allow that too. I mean, you're going to frame it and vet it and all that stuff. But hey, revenge, what we were doing, yeah, sure. But a lot of it was they just wanted to be part of they wanted to be part of something bigger than themselves. And it sounds corny, but it's the reason why anybody joins anything. And so they want to be part of something good. Most people don't want to waste their life. And so I kind of quickly understood that, and I got a good, not a reputation, knowing who I was junior, but I had a good track record of being able to talk to marginal, what we thought were marginal people, but really people on the margins, and then getting them to amplify their stuff, because we kind of got motivated and enthusiastic, and hell, it could even be fun.
One way of doing that, Pat, is you think about where the conversation could go in advance. That is, you spend a little bit of time or a lot of time before meeting with the asset or the contact, and charting out the directions you think it might go. What did that teach you about how to anticipate what people are going to bring up and how to make the most use out of it?
It was a huge thing. I literally storyboarded conversations. I would say like, did you see this guy? And if he said yes, I would ask this question. I wrote it out. And if he said no, I would ask these two questions. And then, why? And okay, and if he did this, I would ask this question. So I would frame it, and it was really helpful because I spent so much time on it. I didn't spend any time during the meetings worrying about my questions. I was worried about his answers and then how I, the pathways to those answers. And so I did that throughout. I mean, once I got into Jordan and other places, I had more traditional tours, but it was still the exact same thing. It was less scripted because you're not writing in front of people, but it was the exact same thing. I'm going to ask this guy this. And because people speak in patterns and they kind of think in patterns, at least, most rational people, and you can figure it out. And it was really, really gratifying to see. And so on a professional level, I loved it. It was really interesting. But on a macro, Gore, my friends are going to kill me when I say that word macro. I started to see that it wasn't really working. I was having pretty good success. A lot of us were having great little tactical meetings. And then the whole time Afghanistan was falling apart.
Talk a little bit about that contrast, because it sounds like on the one hand, you're saying you're meeting with sources, you're figuring out how to get the best information out of them, and you are getting there. You're actually creating a lot of good reports that are useful.
Yeah.
And yet, when it comes to the grand task in a place like Afghanistan of nation building, all of those little pieces didn't seem to add up to very much in the big picture.
Yeah. I mean, we're a nation building where there wasn't a nation to begin with. I mean, it was creation. I mean, there was no nation in the modern sense of the world, especially in the way that we think in terms of contracting and white papers. And so every time I went back, and I kept going back a lot, it was worse, like demonstrably worse. And it corresponded with more Americans there. We put more money, more lives, more firepower in it. And after like the fifth number three in Al-Qaeda, I'm like, methinks they might have a lot of number threes. And
we kept taking out that operational manager, right? Year after year.
And after a while you're like, well, okay. I mean, that's, we got an arbitrage a little bit. That's great. Yay. But, then you're thinking, okay, well then the next week it's this guy and the next week it's this guy. And we're spending so much time to do this. And I'm not saying it's not important, you know, because you can think of it that we kept them off foot. And that's why there isn't another 9/11. I mean, that is an argument. I don't know if it's true or not, but I do know that we spent a lot of time and money to do that at least. But the situation on the ground got worse, way worse every time.
Yeah. You've said that among other things, that your experience at CIA working in the counterintelligence, counterinsurgency, more than that, counterterrorism, even more than that realms, that it taught you that the more you knew, the more you figured out you didn't know. And you were really aware of how much you didn't know, even after you'd been in a place for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it was humbling. And I mean, I've never, you know, boasted, I've never thought myself of, you know, knowing a lot of stuff. I'm humbled by reality, but that job humbled me, because even when I would, you know, give a briefing and I knew a lot about this guy, the number four and whatever it was, and I could say, this is his phone number and this is the selector and he lives here and he talks to this guy and here's link analysis, which I really didn't know, but I was an operations officer, so I could fake it. And so I could talk about a target, and then I realized, man, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Like, I'm talking about this guy as if he exists in isolation, and I don't know anything else about that. We're driving through places, and then I moved over to Asadabad and other places in the east, and it was very, very different and really much more active in terms of bad guys, I guess, anti-good. And so I was just aware of that. I mean, that you could start not just filling warehouses with all the stuff I didn't know, but like universes. I didn't even know. I just knew enough to cause problems, and it was very aware. I wasn't disgruntled. I mean, I've seen some things that said I left the CIA disgruntled. I did not. I left the CIA because my dad was dying and I just needed a change, but I wasn't disgruntled. I mean, the job was great and the people I work with are awesome. It was great. It was, and actually no one believes me, but you know, it was apolitical completely. I never had a political conversation in 7.5 years.
So it's fair to say that all that you talked about, that later on you've reflected and said, wow, we really weren't doing this. We weren't getting what we needed for nation building. We weren't doing the best job to alleviate the causes of this terrorism in the first place. At the time, that wasn't driving you away. You still believed in that mission.
Yeah, I mean, then I went to Iraq. My last thing was in Iraq. So I did the year there, had a, on paper, very, very successful tour, but some devastating losses, coast bombing, and then some other stuff that happened in country. Yeah. And, then I started realizing, like, it wasn't CIA specific. It was war and terror in general. And because that was where I was, I wasn't in Afghanistan when we were worried about corn and all that stuff. I was there too early and then, or too short a time after, you know, later on I went, you know, for like 2005, 2006, short month at a time. Mm-hmm. I was there for a year in the beginning. But when I was in Iraq, it was 2009. So it was right when we were setting up the SOFA status of forces agreement and stuff. And right. Then I was very, very, very aware of the messaging and trying to, you know, win hearts and minds and all the counter messaging and all this stuff. At the same time, I could see what we were doing. And that was when I was very aware of, I didn't really think about it at the time, but it did stick out, policing. You know, like the absence of local police was what was causing all of this. You could see it. The absence of law and order at some level was causing chaos. And then we would go in and we would stop the chaos through sheer violence. And it would work for like a week. And, you know, I went to Fallujah, I went to all these places and I could see it. And I just knew it wasn't working. And I did. I left Iraq, and then – I mean, I was very sad when I left. I moved back to Savannah because I didn't know where to go. We moved back here to help my family and stuff like that. But I was damaged. You know, I'll be very, very honest. I don't think I've ever talked about that. But that summer when I got back in fall, you know, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And by then I was, I don't know, almost 40.
So tell me, I mean, at this point you've had some pretty remarkable experiences, not just the ice breaking, which is awesome, but
it's cool.
You've met the King of Jordan. You've met the Emir of Qatar. You've talked to the president of Afghanistan, and somehow you transition to becoming a cop and you just start over again in the police department.
Yeah. Also, also, I met the president of the United States. Real fast story. I was brand new Capitol Police. I was assigned to Senate Protection. So I would drive like Senator Daschle. He was the majority leader to and from work, whatever like that. And then for the State of the Union, they said, okay, I was going to be with Hamid Karzai, but then he went into the president's box. So he didn't, you know, he had Secret Service. And so they said, okay, you are going to escort Governor Pataki. And then they put me literally next to Governor Pataki, who's like 6'6", I guess. And I'm like, what, 4'9"? And so he actually made a great joke. He said, am I supposed to pick you up and hold you in front of me like a shield? And I said, I don't know, you know, maybe. And so they ended up putting me with Mayor Bloomberg, who had just won election as the mayor. And I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to like escort him into the chamber. So I sat at the Axis of Evil. I sat on the floor next to Bloomberg and watched, you know, the President George Bush gave the speech. And then I took him down to this room and I didn't know I wasn't supposed to go in there. And I walk into this room and all of a sudden I get spun around because all these people come in and there is President George W. Bush looking at me and he expects me to start introducing him to all the people in the room. And because the only person that should be there is like a staff or someone that's supposed to be there. And so I'm like, well, you know, Mr. President, this is Mayor Bloomberg. And I believe that's, you know, Senate majority leader over here. I just started introducing people and then ran away.
So basically what you're telling me is there are reasons that you haven't held a job for a long period of time in your career.
Yeah. And it's also it also highlighted like the Forrest Gump nature, like the timing of everything was always weird. It was just, you know, it wasn't skill. It was luck. I mean, and actually now I'm a huge believer in luck, but yeah, so I left the agency and they were really cool. They were like, hey, do not quit. They'd spent, you know, what, $70 to train me. And so they said, don't quit. You speak Arabic. And my Arabic was at the time decent. I mean, it would have been better just to hire a native, you know, speaker, but whatever. And so they didn't want me to leave. And I remember talking to, you know, the chief of CTC and stuff. And they said, hey, take a couple years off, whatever you want, leave without pay, whatever. And I just said, I remember thinking, I was like, no.
If you leave, you're not coming back.
Yeah, I was like, I think I'm done. No hard feelings. And I really mean that. And then I deliberately rolled back my cover because I wanted to make sure that I didn't want to regret anything.
Mm-hmm. Explain for everyone rolling back your cover.
Okay, so if I hadn't rolled back my cover, I would have said that I was a State Department employee forever or a defense, you know, whatever government job that they put me under, I would not be able to say CIA. And so and it's much easier when you're a CTC case officer because you don't have a lot of long running cases. Mm-hmm. And so they can roll back my cover because they didn't really care. And so that allowed me to become something that, which I ended up hating, but at the time it was fine, a former CIA officer.
Right.
Which became the only reason why anyone wanted to talk to me, which I understood. And then another Forrest Gump moment, I lucked into somebody said, hey, I know Ali Soufan. And I was here. I was in Savannah, and they put me in touch with Ollie, and we clicked. And I worked with him for, 5-6 years, and doing amazing stuff. Like I had experiences that, you know, I've met prime ministers. I mean, I traveled a lot with him at very, very high level because he was doing counterviolent extremism, but also, you know, anti-torture, what he's known for, and which I agreed on too, but I had no experience in it. And so I really enjoyed it. I traveled, you know, I'd go to Singapore. I loved it. It was a great job. That's when I stepped out and started doing media and became a talking blurb, basically. It was, they didn't really care what I said. And, you know, I don't mean any harm by that. I mean, I think they're great people. But it didn't matter what I said as long as I said something. And then there was, you know, a former CIA officer said this, which is fine. I got it. And then right around ISIS, which, you know, we all knew was coming back. And I actually recognized some of the guys. And so in 2014, I just started, then it was like, okay, Skinner's got to start talking about this. And I hadn't been to those places in, you know, 4 years. And so I started to feel like a fraud.
Yeah.
And I've said that before, and it really bothered me. But because it was two things going on, I was talking about places I hadn't been in a long time, about things I really didn't know about. Even when I was in it, I didn't know about it at the level I was talking about. I didn't know country level stuff. I knew one guy stuff. And so, but at the same time, if I wasn't traveling, I was here in Savannah. And we intentionally live in a, you know, up and coming struggling neighborhood. We live in East Savannah, and because it's really cheap and we didn't want any bills. And so I walked around my neighborhood and I could see like what was going on. And so I would bounce my little red ball and I'd walk around thinking about all the intel briefs I had to write and, you know, all the other stuff I had to write. And so I started saying that, well, I can name this guy in Syria or this guy in Iraq or this guy in Lebanon, but I couldn't tell you what was going on with the gang that was spray painting stuff four houses away from my house. Right. And it started to really annoy me. And I remember I gave a speech, I forgot the name, they're going to kill me, but I gave a speech in Grand Rapids. And it was a speech about ISIS, and I had memorized it. I had memorized a 50-minute speech, and I delivered it really well. And I realized while I was giving it, I didn't want to do that anymore. And you could see it. I actually watched it later on, and you could see there was a moment where I just said, I think I don't want to do this. And so then I started thinking about it, and because we don't have any kids, we could be, you know, I can afford to be stupid. We, you know, there's no one really relying on me. So had a conversation. And then at that time, a friend of mine in the agency, I only have a couple, was killed in Afghanistan. And that cut me in half, because he and I went there the first time in 2003. He, you know, he was in the farm with me. He was my, one of my few friends. And he was killed, you know, 10 years later at a place, well, maybe more than that. I don't know how long. That was 2003. Yeah, so like 13 years later, he was killed doing the exact same thing, like five blocks from where he was doing it 13 years before that. And except it wasn't the Taliban or AQ. Now it was ISIS and, you know, Khorasan. And that hurt. And I said, I'm done. I don't want to do this. I don't think I can make any positive change at that level. And I don't think anyone can. That was the thing. The trick was I believe that no one could, and that I wanted to just help my neighborhood. And that was it.
And that's when you went to the Savannah Police Department.
That is correct. Yep.
Support for today's Lawfare podcast comes from the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. As an attorney, you can help your community improve through service and the pursuit of justice. At Mitchell Hamlin, you can study the law in a way that fits your life. There are full-time and part-time options both on campus and online. The law school has an over 100-year tradition of a rigorous, practice-based approach to legal education that prepares students to add value in their communities. In addition to its JD program, Mitchell Hamlin offers legal education certifications in cybersecurity and privacy law, elder law, healthcare administration, and human resource compliance. In a time when so many law schools are switching to online platforms, Mitchell Hamlin has an established record of providing high-quality legal education in online, in-person, and blended forms. Learn more at mitchellhamlin.edu. That's mitchellhamlin.edu.
So let's talk about, with all of that background, that's important to understand the contrasts and the message that you're talking about now when it comes to a different way of looking at national security. It's our security within the nation, and you're dealing with that at the street level, at the block level now. So talk about that a little bit. Your mindset coming in was obviously different than a lot of your fellow officers starting out. How did you manage that in terms of bringing those experiences to bear in a way that they in some ways could not?
Well, I had to quickly accept that I was not going to win physical fitness like I did in the Capitol Police. That was not going to happen again. But it was very, it was really interesting because I had gone through this. FLETC is Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. Yep. And so I went through something called GIPSTIC, which is the Georgia Peace Officer Training Center. So it's the exact same thing, but state level. And it's pretty much the same thing, except the feds were way more funded. And so this time I went through it and I got to watch it kind of like, you know, almost 20 years later. Very bemused, and kind of got to focus on what they were doing because I wasn't worried about passing or anything like that. And so I just kind of I focused on what they focused on, and I was just amazed at, you know, like, oh, we spend a lot of time on handcuffing because that is important. You right. do want to get good at that skill. We focus on shooting and driving because those are high liability things, and if you're going to get sued, it's going to be from those things.
How much time did they spend in the training on effective listening?
Yeah, there was none of that. And I'm not, you know, crapping on the training. It's fine. It needs to change. But at the time, it's fine. But so I could really see what they were training us for. And even then, I'd never been a local cop. I didn't know anything about it. But I knew that I probably wasn't as afraid, or I shouldn't be as afraid as they wanted us, or they said we should be, because everyone's going to kill you. And that not just that anyone could kill you, but that they would. Everybody, if given the chance, would cut your head off with a chainsaw that you didn't see.
And that was part of the training, right?
Yeah, but it permeated everything. It permeated like the constitutional right classes, which were kind of interesting because we talked about case law. But the case law was focused on what we could get away with, you know, the protections for the officer and not the protections for the other people. And so I noticed it. I just thought, oh, that's, you know, this is kind of a waste of time. And the fact that they have you here, they should probably start focusing. But I didn't know enough about what actual street work was. And then I, you know, graduate and I go to Central Precinct, which is true inner city policing. It is violent at one level, but not in a, almost every other way. And it sounds weird, but it's true. And so I just quickly kind of, because, you know, the case officer mentality is to avoid conflict. You don't have disagreements. You don't have conflicts. Your whole ethos is to get along with everybody. And if you do it at a really obvious level, you become that smarmy, gland-handing fake guy. And so no one liked that guy. I got that. I wasn't good enough to become the, you know, smarmy, glad-handing fake guy. But I could just be like the non-objectionable, short, sweaty guy. And that was what I was aiming for. And then I started realizing that, well, this is an effective way to do this because I'm not mad and I'm not yelling and I'm certainly not afraid. Yeah. I mean, I had guns pointed. I mean, yeah, we did. I mean, it was dangerous, but those dangers were manageable or they're certainly short-lived. And so I just started seeing like, wow, this is so much different than what they're telling us. And what they were telling us was basically counterinsurgency. Mm-hmm. So I had seen it and I'd really seen it in Iraq and other places and, you know, winning hearts and minds. And they were talking about community leaders and the military had those KLEs, a key, you know, like meetings and stuff, key leader engagements. That's what they were. Mm-hmm. And so they would go out and have, you know, they break bread and with the imam or whatever it was with the shura. You know, we go to a shura and acted like we do what you want. And but it really, we were just paying the warlord to do whatever we wanted. But here we were doing it, but we were actually believing it, I guess. But we also didn't have any money. So it was very ineffective. And so they would talk about like, yeah, we've got the religious leaders.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit more because there's some real interesting contrasts there. I mean, you talked about how when you were working overseas, you often had plenty of money to pay
unlimited
dinners with sources or to actually pay them for information. I assume that's not even fair to compare and contrast that with the amount of money you have as a police officer to build community relations.
Yeah, I mean, I have zero. Yeah, I mean, I spent my own money.
Right.
But yeah, but in terms of, yeah, it's not even, I mean, it's not even, there's no comparison. It's not even, it's to murder the word analogy to even try to compare it.
Talk about the information collection side. You talked about how you were able to collect a lot of tactical information from people. Maybe it didn't build up to nation building level strategic information, but you were able to get a lot of information from people. How does that feel about walking around and knowing the streets?
So it was so different because, like, you know, the agency, they didn't teach you to be sneaky, but you were clandestine. The whole point was clandestine. Well, here I'm walking around with my badge. My actual real name is on my uniform and I'm hopping out of a car that screams, you know, police, CIA, whatever, you know, whatever it is. And I go into these neighborhoods and I say, hey guys, trust me, I'll be here for the next 6 hours. And so I quickly understood, like, that's impossible. That type of even tactical level of engagement. I mean, I guess I could, you would have to start, you know, having them work off charges. You need confidential sources, which I was not, as a patrol officer, I'm not doing that. You know, right. Even as a detective, I have no interest in that because mm-hmm. I figured out a way to get around that. But it was weird. So we're talking about winning hearts and minds when every single thing we did was to step on those hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. And we were begging people and we would have the, you know, I see billboards, they're, you know, like, trust us, you know, literally trust us. At the exact time, we would never, there is no way I would ever trust somebody. You know, I'm not trusting you, screw you. It's us versus them. And sometimes it's put that clearly. Other times it's just like, no, it's everybody wants to kill you. Mm-hmm. You know, trust at your own peril. And I started to say, well, no, I think that distrust is at our own peril. And so what I did was, I mean, a lot of it was happening. It was all happenstance. I wasn't intentional then. It's very intentional now. But at that time, I just, you know, I'm a little person. I'm short. And I'm not going to get into a fight. And so I started realizing, hey, I'm not going to bully anybody because I've never been a bully. So why would I become a bully now with a badge? In fact, now I'm really not supposed to be a bully because I can back it up with the power of the state or get my bigger friends to do something. And so I didn't want to do that. And I didn't. And so I just started thinking, like, I need to come up with ways so I avoid fights. It wasn't that I was afraid of getting, you know, I've been in a lot of fights, but I wasn't afraid of getting into a fight. I just thought they were so stupid. or, you know, being mean to somebody, you know, being rude to people or especially in handcuffs, like they're in handcuffs, you won. And so what I did was I came up with this thing. If you didn't have a badge and a gun, how would you handle this call? And now I'm asking other people that, but at the time I asked myself that every second of the day, how would I handle this? If it's not a crime, because most calls we went out to were not crimes, still 80%, I'll go at least 80% are not crime. They're near crime. They're trending towards crime. If you don't show up, there might be a crime, but there isn't one. And so you don't have criminals yet. So why are we treating everybody like they're a criminal? Because crime is easy. You walk up and you're like, hey, the elements of the crime are this. Probable cause means this guy, put him in cuffs. That's easy. Now the mechanics of putting on the cuffs might be problematic. That's up to that guy. But the violence isn't going to come from me. Yeah. And so I started focusing on all the other things that we were doing.
Talk a little bit about the consequences of that, though, because you walk into a situation and honestly, you have a lot of uncertainty about what's going on. Maybe a crime has been reported. Maybe it hasn't. Maybe the call that came in implied that something seriously bad was about to go down. Most officers will walk in with a hand on their weapon.
Or the gun out.
Yeah.
I learned real fast, if you have it out, you're going
to
use it.
And you don't want to do that. And yet, you have people who will say to you, and they are telling the truth, is lives have been lost that way when an officer went in using the word unprepared or using the word too slow to react. And actually, an officer went down because they weren't prepared to use that force. So how do you square that?
Yeah, well, because I don't think that's true. I mean, officers are killed all the time. I'm not saying they're not. I'm saying that there was nothing short of not going to work that day. If you hit that call, whoever was standing on that X was going to get killed. And, my sergeant was murdered last year. The guy stepped out of the car and shot him. There is nothing to learn from that. And it's a really painful thing to say. And I'm not disparaging him. He was a great sergeant. I mean, he died helping his community. But there is no lesson to learn. We're not going to say like, oh, you can't approach a car unless you have a shield and a gun out. That's not what the thing was. Whoever responded to that call, the guy's going to shoot it, you're going to probably die. And I don't want to be that guy. But the job is someone might be that guy.
And yet the trend has been that direction, right? The trend has been to use a word that's common, to militarize the police, not for traffic stops, but for any event involving a crowd, for any event involving
for everything. It's not even crowds. It's everything, because you're trained to keep distance, which I understand. I mean, I'm not an idiot. I mean, well, I am an idiot, but I'm not suicidal. And so, but I'm very comfortable with people kind of being loud around me and people kind of being towering over me and getting close to me because I'm little and I don't really care. And I'm watching their hands. I'm watching their feet. I know if you turn your feet somewhere, you're probably going to move a certain way. I pay attention. I really do. And if your hands are doing a certain thing, I don't care what your mouth is doing, but I'm looking at your hands. But I can do that while I'm smiling. You know, I can do that while I'm understanding. I'm not afraid to hug somebody because they might pull out a katana sword that I didn't see and kill me. And so I just started saying, well, we're training. And I called it the Cheney doctrine of policing, because remember he had that 1%. Right. If it was a 1% probability, you treat it as a certainty.
Yeah.
And that's why we had the WMD.
Right.
I get it. And so I was like, well, we're doing the Cheney doctrine for policing. If anybody can possibly kill you in the scenario, it's 100% that they want to and they're capable of it. So you have got to create a situation where they can't.
Yep.
And of course, again, if someone wants to shoot you, they're going to shoot you. You know, you're going to walk in the door, they're going to shoot you. So we rush into these scenes. And one thing the agency taught me was to be really aware of what you don't know. And with these calls, you don't know anything. In fact, you have anti-knowledge, because most of the shit you're getting is wrong. Or it's certainly, because most people don't call the cops and say, hey, it's not that important, show up, you know, not that big a deal. They call 911 because it's a big deal to them. Now, what is a big deal to them might not be a big deal in the safety sense. But so by definition, 911 is a hype machine. You know, they're calling because it's an emergency. Sometimes it's way more dramatic than they make. And that's always weird. Mm-hmm. And so I vividly remember I was in training and I said, hey, what's the number at the bottom of the screen? And the guy said, oh, that's the guy who called. Yeah. And I'm like, well, why aren't we calling that guy? And they said, well, you can have dispatch call them. I'm like, okay, well, I have a phone right here. It works. And I don't have to do an SDR and change SIM cards and handsets. I can literally just call and say, my name is Patrick Skinner. What's going on? They tell you, and then you can get on the radio and say, hey, everyone, slow down. The guy with the shotgun is not a guy with a shotgun. Or you can say, speed up. The guy with the shotgun is really there.
Yep.
Most of the time, it's slow up. Sometimes it's speed up.
Right.
But it also gave me this thing where it was really cool. I got to step out And some, these scenes are very loud, very chaotic, and scary in a superficial way. And so I got the sail out and I looked right at them, and it was just like being a, you know, search and rescue in the Coast Guard. These people are locked in on you. And I, you know, I step out of the car just like I did in the Coast Guard. I'm a life preserver. And they look at me and I go, "Hey, Officer Skinner, we just spoke, you know, connection." And I tell everybody, it's superficial. Yes, it is. Is it effective? God, yes, it's very effective. And so I started doing that.
I mean, is that something that you think, based on talking to other police officers, is that something that could be trained on and could be applied in diverse situations in other departments?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it should be. A lot of the younger officers, because I became a training officer, they do it. And I say, "Hey, I can't tell you what to do, but you know, you should do this." But most people have the same reaction. You're calling from your own phone. And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't have any anytime minutes. You know, I'm not paying for this." And they go, no, they have your phone number." I'm like, "Yeah, because in the beginning, first day, not even the first day, the first half a day, I block my number on the iPhone, you know, block caller ID." Mm-hmm. And surprise, nobody answered, because who answers a block call?
Right.
So then I just call from the local area code and they answer.
Yeah.
And then they have my phone number.
Mm-hmm.
And people are like, "Oh my God, you gave them your phone number?" I'm like, "Yeah." And if they need me, they'll call me. And I tell people, "Hey, if you have an emergency, call 911. If it's something, you know, no big deal, you want to ask a question or you want to tell me something, call Skinner." And so they did. I have hundreds of people. And I had to tell people, stop being afraid. What are they going to do if they have your phone number?
Yeah.
Are they going to tap your phone like the rush? I mean, I don't understand what the downside was. And so I still face that. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying that everything I do is right and that other people are wrong. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, at least in this scene, it makes sense to call this because I'm the one that's going to step out into that 911 call, not the dispatcher.
That gets to a point that you've talked about before, which is just changing the mindset away from the enemy, away from punishment, away from military to, you know, the term battle space being used for local policing, and moving to treating people like they are, which is your neighbors. How does that mindset apply in those situations where lethal force might be a possibility? Because most, at least my neighbors, we don't have the possibility of using lethal force against each other on a regular basis.
Yeah, and we do. I mean, and you know, I understand that. And that is I find it to be more of a burden. I mean, a lot of time, you know, I'm glad I have a gun, you know, I guess. But a lot of times I wish I didn't, at least for that moment. But yeah, like the mindset of how could you give them your phone number? Well, I can. If you think of them as your neighbor, then why would they not have your phone number? But, you know, why would you give the enemy your phone number? And so it used to drive me crazy. I'm like, what do you think they're going to do? Are they going to spam you? Are they going to prank call you? I mean, they know you're a cop. They're not going to prank call you.
What's the worst call you've ever had? Not an official call, but a call to your personal cell phone in the middle of the night that you weren't expecting because you gave someone your number.
I get that all the time. I mean, I have, and there are a handful of struggling neighbors that, you know, they're living in tents and they're constantly being moving around. And so they call me a lot. And sometimes I wish they wouldn't, but I said I would answer the phone and I do. And it's like 5 minutes of my life. It's not that big a deal.
Okay.
But the mindset, it's just like, look, if you're not afraid to give someone your phone number, then why don't you just start carrying that to other things? You're not afraid to listen to them. You're not afraid to not tell them to do shit when you don't know what's going on. Don't give them an order if they're screaming and hollering and they can't comply with it, because then you get into a thing where you have to make them do it.
Right.
And is it really, really that important to tell them to sit down right now or not, you know, yell? If it's not, and sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's not. So don't give them that order, because once you do that, you put the clock is running.
Yeah.
And you're not going to sit there and tell them five times, "I told you to do this. I told you to do this." You're not doing that. You're going to tell them a couple times and then you're going to make them do it. And so the trick is, don't tell them.
Let's take this up a level. So you're talking about the human to human relations here and getting that to the level of a program. I understand that's not your job, but let's be hypothetical here. Let's say that you are reallocating police resources at a large level. And you're taking money probably away from what you would call the militarization of police. Every police department in the country does not need to look like a full-out unit in Iraq. Where does that money go? Does it go to training police officers on this kind of listening, reacting, neighborly thinking? Or does it go to actual community programs to put more people into situations where they're seeing police officers as their neighbors instead of as their enemies?
I mean, the skeptic in me, knowing that I can get more acceptance if I say put that money into the police department. So then I would say, sure, put that money into training. You know, the police, you know, they need that money. But the honest answer is spend that money somewhere else. What I'm talking about costs nothing. In fact, it saves money because you're probably going to have a lot less lawsuits.
Right.
And then also you're just going to have, I mean, it's going to lower the baseline tensions of everything. If you did it, there's no shortcut. The whole point is you got to do it every time. You just can't be like, you know, like an asshole only 10% of the time. You just got it. You can't do that. We never accept that. Like, hey, this surgeon had a bad day. Tough crap, you know, mm-hmm. Or the pilot just said, you know, he was upset. He got in a fight with his wife. So he decided to crash a plane in the mountain. We don't do that with other professions that involve life or death. But for some reason, the police are the only ones where we say, oh, they're human. They're only human. Well, we do not say, hey, the surgeon, he's only human. You know, he was hungover and he, you know, he killed your grandfather. We don't accept that. And if we want to be a profession, then we have to have standards and ethics. And that's how you do it. You don't accept it. You can't be just human because someone called you a name. I actually giggle. I mean, I get disappointed when it's just a boring name. Sometimes it's pretty inventive. I actually laugh. I'm like, nah, that's hateful. You know, that stings a little bit because it's true. But the money isn't an issue. Now, yeah, we're paid like garbage. My department just raised their pay, and it's the highest anywhere in this area, and it's $44,000, which is ridiculous. But if you need a lot of police officers, because the system is designed, you know, for a lot of police officers, and it's everything else is designed that we need a lot of police officers because we screw everything up, we shortchange everything up until the 911 call. Mm-hmm. So everything that would prevent the 911 call, we don't spend any money on, but we're going to spend the money on right after the 911 call. But not on actual paying more salaries, just slightly better, but a lot more cops. We need more cops. And if more cops meant, you know, safety, I mean, yes, at some point you have to have a level of police officers enough to handle certain things. But if more cops meant safety, then Washington, D.C. would be the places, you know, safest place on earth. You know, Baltimore, Chicago, they have a lot of police officers. But the social issues and the drivers of crime, which aren't poverty, but they certainly aren't helped by that, they would be safe. And they're not. Well, I mean, most places in those areas are safe, and it's concentrated in these areas. And so I don't think we need to spend more money on police. I think we need to spend more money on everything that keeps you from calling the police.
I understand. So let me close with this. You've had these beliefs for some time. Like you said, some of these ideas were forming when you were working on intelligence in Afghanistan and Iraq. But even since you came to the force, you've had these ideas clearly in your head, and yet you've avoided doing things like going back on national television or writing op for a while. And then something in the last 10 days to 2 weeks changed your mind and flipped a switch for you. What happened in your thinking that said, now's the time I need to be speaking out more?
Because I had this weird self-loathing. I hated my stupid Twitter feed. It's, you know, I have more than some people have followers, I guess, because of former media stuff, but now it's because of a stupid cat. And I accept that, even though I think Baked Potato is much cooler. So I accept that. But basically, everything I say is really banal. It's obvious, you know, don't be an ass, you know, be nice to people. And so I think of Twitter as my diary. I literally come home and almost every day, I literally write home, period. And then I kind of just do a sanitized version because I'm trying to process what just happened. And you'll know it's really bad if I don't say anything because I don't talk about arrest. And it's funny, people are like, oh, well, Skinner doesn't talk about uses of force or arrest. No, one, because those are legal cases and I'm not an idiot. And also, two, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm very intentional about this. And so, you know, I've done, 3 years of this now where I go, hey, we don't have to be this way. We don't have to be this way. And then I still remember I was working Memorial Day. That was that Monday. And I'm in the detective office now. Yay. And I saw the video of George Floyd,
right.
And there was a murder. And so this was coming right on top of the Ahmaud Arbery, who was hunted and killed down in Brunswick by, three white people, which was just egregious. And if that hadn't happened, if the George Floyd murder hadn't happened, this would have probably, you know, still gotten some traction.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there watching the George Floyd thing. And because I normally don't actually watch stuff. People always ask me to comment and stuff, and I don't get defensive because I understand I'm responsible, but I'm not to blame. Mm-hmm. But it gets weary trying to say, you know, yeah, it sucks. They shouldn't have done this. So I watch this, and I'm like, man, this guy is flat out murdering this guy. And that's bad enough. Like, I'm watching that. That's terrible. It's actually terrible. I mean, the vision of his neck still kills me. But what really killed me was seeing the guy, little short, pudgy guy right there, the new cop, brand new. He's on day four or three, depending on who you're training. And the guy who's murdering the guy is his training officer, which I was until a couple months ago. And he's standing there, and not only is he not doing anything as a human being, but he doesn't know what to do as a cop because he's been a cop for 3 days, but he's stopping other people from helping. And then, you know, I've seen some, the legal defense, well, if people thought it was a murder, they should have rushed the cops. Yeah, that's, yeah. We kill people for that, but yeah, go ahead and try to do that. And so I saw that, and it, you know, I had the same reaction everyone else did. And I went home and I cried my little eyes out, and I hated it. And then some editor from the Washington Post said, hey, you want to speak out? And I mean, I'm not famous. I get some of these invitations every now and then, and I always say no. I pick and choose stuff, but for the most part, for 3 years, I've said no. Because I'm not a leader. I have 3 years as a local cop. I'm not, you know, going to be chief of police. But I saw that, and I just said, whatever platform I have, however, you know, mean cat-centric it is, or however small it is in the big scheme of things, and it's tiny, whatever I got, I'm given. And so I just wrote it, and it hurt. And then I was just like, you know, it just, oh God, it kept happening. It keeps happening. And it doesn't keep happening to like random people. It happens to African-Americans. It happens to poor people. You know, it doesn't happen to the rich guy on Wall Street. And I'm not saying it should happen to him to even the scales. I'm saying it shouldn't happen to anybody.
Right.
And so I was just like, the answer is in this war.
Yeah. Patrick, thank you for speaking out about this. Thanks for joining us. And good luck back on the job tomorrow.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share this podcast and rate the podcast wherever you find it. And don't forget to visit the Lawfare store. Many items are delayed in shipping everywhere, but we have some items in stock for quick shipping, like Lawfare notebooks, Lawfare pens, Lawfare socks, and Lawfare lapel pins. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo Studios here in D.C. was our audio engineer. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.